Hello and welcome back to the National Cancer Prevention Workshop, produced each year by LessCancer.org, an organization that is focused on prevention of cancer. My name is Miles O'Brien. I'm chairman of the board of that organization, and we are conducting a series of conversations this year with thought leaders, educators, doctors who are focused on prevention of cancer, specifically how disparities in healthcare access affect cancer and its spread. We're calling this the John Dingell Cancer Health Disparities and Access Interviews. And we're proud to have as our guest today, Dr. Vikrat Sasrabudi. He is the deputy chief of the Breast and Gynecological Cancer Research Group and the program director in the Division of Cancer Prevention at the National Cancer Institute. Vic, it's really nice to have you with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Miles. It's great to be here, and thank you for inviting me to Less Cancer's great workshop that you put together for addressing cancer prevention.
It's a pleasure. Let's talk a little bit about cervical cancer, HPV, and HIV. These are conversations which overlap, of course. First of all, HPV. Tell us a little bit about that. There is a high percentage of people, probably a surprising number to most, who at some time in their life will be exposed to the HPV virus, right?
That's correct. It's estimated that around 3 out of 4 individuals will carry HPV at some point in their lives, and most will not even notice it. It's a very highly prevalent virus, but it also transmits very easily. It's a sexually transmitted virus, but can also transmit through skin-to-skin contact and other means. But it's only in a minority of participants, minority of people who actually have the virus, that it has potential to progress and cause changes in the body that can lead on to cancer development. And cervical cancer is one of the more prominent cancers caused due to HPV.
So that is a stunning number, 3 out of 4. But as you say, mostly we don't have to worry about that. That said, HPV leads to an estimated 5% of all the cancers in the world. So it is something to reckon with, isn't it?
It is. And the amazing part about knowing and having the knowledge and the tools to detect as well as to prevent HPV is what makes this cancer really interesting from a public health point of view. I think it's amongst the very few cancers for which we know a obligate cause that causes those cancers, but it's also something that we have the tools to prevent them, both from a highly effective vaccine that can actually prevent the acquisition of the virus, but also methods to detect the cancer early through detecting the lesions that cause cancer and catch them at an early stage. So it is one of the leading causes of cancer-related morbidity and mortality globally. More than 600,000 women all over the world are detected every year due to cervical cancer. More than 300,000 of them die due to cervical cancer. That's almost 2 women every minute.
The numbers are actually quite stunning. Cervical cancer kills in excess of 340,000 women each year. Every 2 minutes, a woman loses her life due to cervical cancer. And let's make this as clear as we can. That's completely preventable, isn't it?
It is. And that's the amazing part. If we put all our resources and do all that we can in a concerted way, I think this is one cancer that we can safely say that we can actually eliminate over the next several decades.
Well, let's talk about the barriers, though. You can't just wave a magic wand in this world. There's all kinds of inequalities. And this is probably a poster child for the role of inequalities and disparities in health outcomes, I would say. Wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Cervical cancer is a cancer that is associated with individuals who have lack of access to healthcare. They are typically individuals with lower socioeconomic strata, lower educational attainment, or have other physical, geographic, financial, and other barriers that put them at higher risk for either acquiring the risk factor, but also at not being able to access the right care, either through vaccination or screening, that puts them at higher risk for the development of those cancers. And then there's also co-infections and comorbidities, such as HIV, that overlay on top of the HPV infection and increase the risk for individuals to develop cervical cancer over time.
So the HPV vaccine works, doesn't it? And is, first of all, when we think about vaccines on the tail end of COVID, although we're still in the middle of COVID, really, we think, first of all, about vaccine hesitancy. And also, frankly, during COVID, I'm sure people weren't getting to doctors the way they were. The rate of vaccines, is that return to pre-COVID levels?
So in the United States, they have caught up to the level that they were prior to COVID. Unfortunately, the levels even before COVID were about 70% of all the target populations that we were trying to vaccinate, which is typically girls and boys between the ages of 9 and 15. But the vaccine, of course, is approved all the way till ages 45. It is certainly recommended for those who should take it between ages 9 and 26. But the emphasis is on adolescent vaccination. But due to a variety of factors, HPV vaccine rates and vaccine hesitancy associated with it only allowed the U.S. rates to go up to 70 to 75%. And those rates have not certainly gone up post-COVID. And so we still have a challenge at hand to increase the rates for HPV vaccination, because this is one of the most cost-effective means to prevent cancer and therefore reduce the burden due to this disease.
Let's talk about why people don't get vaccinated for HPV. What are the hurdles? What are the obstacles there?
So a variety of hurdles have been documented, and we from the National Cancer Institute are supporting a lot of research to understand and also address how to overcome these barriers. One of those barriers is around both provider hesitancy and parent hesitancy around vaccination. HPV is, as I mentioned before, is a sexually transmitted virus. And so there were initial concerns that vaccination for pre-adolescents and adolescents would the comfort zone of individuals in a pediatrician's office talking about a vaccine that's for an STD was significantly higher. But then people should also realize, and that's the messaging that is now underway through a variety of ways, that this is a cancer preventive vaccine. The virus may be sexually transmitted, but the actual target for this is to prevent cancer. And so overcoming the parental hesitancy, as well as facilitating means for providers to talk to parents and convince them about the need for cancer prevention that this vaccine allows, is something that a variety of organizations such as the CDC, the American Cancer Society, and the NCI are working collaboratively to address.
These are deep-rooted issues of belief and moray. It can be difficult to overcome these and kind of cut through, the kinds of disinformation that we become familiar with. What's the best strategy to get that out there, to make it clear to people what this is really all about?
I think one of the ways to do this is to increase awareness. I think Less Cancer is doing a phenomenal job of putting the message across that there are cancers for which we can do something about. And I think increasing awareness both for parents as well as for the broader healthcare system that can actually increase access to providing HPV vaccines and reinforcing the messages around the role for a cancer prevention potential for this vaccine and the type of cancers that can be prevented and the morbidities associated with those cancers that can actually vanish if somebody gets vaccinated early on with this vaccine could all be reinforcing messages that can actually enhance the efforts that are already underway to routinely incorporate this vaccine as early as age 9, that can actually increase the rates. And so I think there are several strategies that can be undertaken, but we'll have to work concertedly to achieving high vaccination rates, upwards of 85 or 90% in the US. And so we still have some ways to go. The good news is we are already seeing evidence, which I think is also a reinforcing message, that cervical cancer rates are actually getting reduced in the populations that have been vaccinated. There is increasing evidence from Europe, but also there's increasing evidence about lowering of precancer rates and some early evidence of decreasing cancer rates in some of the youngest populations that were vaccinated since year 2006, when this vaccine became available for the first time, which is, you know, 14 years plus now, and has 16 years plus now, and actually has been showing its impact in terms of reduction of both HPV infection as well as reducing cervical cancer incidence rates in the populations that received the vaccine.
So the other thing to talk about here is screening as well, because with proper screening, you can nip this in the bud, so to speak. Tell us about that, and tell us what can be done to increase the amount of screening that's out there.
So, great question, Miles, because cervical cancer screening is a life-saving intervention. It's better known as pap smears, which a lot of women in the U.S., about 70 to 80% of women are very much doing annual pap smears, or at least a better frequency of pap smears, going to their doctors, and has become part of routine healthcare. Unfortunately, the remaining cases of cervical cancer, which are about 14,000 cases in the US every year, half of those occur in women who are not screened for cervical cancer or very infrequently screened. So we are trying to address some of these inequities for increasing the access of cervical cancer screening rates. And one of them is through person-centric approaches, such as HPV self-sampling. This is an approach where women can actually collect their own samples in the privacy and at the time of their own convenience, and can actually send those samples to a lab for looking at the potential for detection of high-risk oncogenic types of the human papillomavirus, HPV, which is a causative agent for cervical cancer. And if somebody is positive for that virus, that can actually serve as a marker for doing further investigations. The good news is we have those tests that are available, and we are working now with the FDA and with these companies that manufacture these tests to make this as a test that has a regulatory approval for using widely in the United States, that can actually increase access to screening for women who are either reluctant to get screened or have other barriers such as physical, financial, geographic, that can actually prevent them from seeing a doctor. There are several counties in the US where an OBGYN or even a family physician is not available for several hundred miles. And therefore, we do want to sort of go down that path of providing them screening at a place and time where it's most convenient for them, not letting the requirement for having a doctor's visit and a pelvic exam and a collection of a pap smear in a clinic be a barrier to achieving the type of screening that we need for reducing cervical cancer incidence rates.
Let's talk about HIV. A woman who is HIV positive, this further complicates the picture, doesn't it? Explain the nuances of that.
So HIV, or the human immunodeficiency virus, is a immunosuppressive virus, and therefore it reduces the body's immune responses and the ability for the body to clear several infections, including HPV. And so women who have HIV have a higher risk for the HPV virus to progress and cause cervical cancer. They're about 5 or 6 times as likely as women without HIV to have cervical cancer. And that is something that complicates both detection as well as management of cervical cancer in women with HIV, who form one of the highest risk groups, but also in most intervenable groups, because we already provide a lot of care for their HIV infection and keep them alive as a result of providing them antiretroviral therapy for HIV. And so how can we do better, particularly in low and middle income countries, but also in areas with healthcare disparities in the US, to actually improve and ensure that they have the access to life-saving cervical cancer screening tools. So through the National Cancer Institute, we have launched what is called as Cascade, a new network that is focused on improving cervical cancer screening and pre-cancer treatment efforts in women with HIV, because there's always a tendency to fall somewhere in this so-called cascade of linking, screening, management, and treatment. And we are trying to address this burden both in low and middle income countries in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as in areas with fragmented healthcare systems in the United States that can actually improve on cervical cancer screening, management, and pre-cancer treatment optimization, so that we can eventually reduce the rates of cervical cancer in this very high-risk population.
The numbers I see here are about 90% of new cases and deaths of cervical cancer occur in low and middle income countries. So that's clearly where the problem lies. When you try to address it with this program, Cascade, how do you go about it, though? There's so many additional obstacles that you must face as you try to get through the barriers we've already talked about, which probably are augmented by other stigmas.
Absolutely. So we are working very closely with some of the on-the-ground individuals, organizations, as well as ministries of health in countries where we are launching Cascade, initially in three countries in sub-Saharan Africa, but also expected to move to other places globally, as well as in the US. Our emphasis is to identify the most opportune venues, as well as expand the options to increase cervical cancer screening access by working very closely with individuals as well as organizations that cater to those who are affected and infected with HIV as a risk factor. And we are working very closely to improve their perceptions about getting screened, but also how can we increase the linkages between ensuring that those who get screened also get managed appropriately. So a screen positive result triggers a whole range of pathways, including going for a diagnostic exam called colposcopy or undergoing treatment with some methods such as ablation. And those are the steps that actually do not happen as a result of a variety of barriers that each identify, that each present an opportunity for us to intervene. So it requires a whole of a village approach. It requires working with stakeholders across the spectrum. It requires close coordination with research entities, with public health funders, with ministries of health, as well as trying to enhance the capacity in the same places where the burden lies. Primarily, as you might imagine, there is a dearth of well-trained professionals. So we are also trying to increase access to screening by looking at approaches that can optimize the available healthcare manpower resource. So things like task shifting that allow us to transfer some of the tasks related to diagnosis or detection in the hands of non-physician healthcare workers like nurses that can actually overcome a critical barrier to providing the kind of high quality healthcare for these individuals in such resource constrained settings, if you will.
You've laid out a lot of challenges there, Vic. Are you reasonably optimistic you'll be able to get around all of that, plus add the language and cultural barriers? And just the pure cost of trying to get the word out. Do you feel like you can make some progress here?
So, Miles, absolutely. I mean, this is certainly a huge challenge, and I've highlighted a few, but there are certainly a variety of challenges that I couldn't even talk about. I think the good news in some ways is this problem of being able to address the problem of cervical cancer, but also the opportunity to address prevention and control for cervical cancer is being recognized at the highest levels in both international as well as national governments. And so we do have a level of support. The WHO, for example, called for elimination of public health problem and increasing targets for screening to 90% and 70% and 90% of vaccination, screening, and pre-cancer treatment access by the year 2030. And therefore, we are trying to work with a variety of these stakeholders and taking advantage of the momentum that actually has resulted in the past few years. And also, I think as a result of seeing COVID in action and people realizing the importance of preventative healthcare, I think will probably help us in the long run as we try to handle this one of the more preventable cancers.
You know, I hope you're right. But I do think it's worth pointing out that historically, we don't fund public health very well, do we? What can we do to make sure that there is sustained funding and attention to what is required to maintain good, solid public health that is informed by good science?
You absolutely nailed it on the head. Public health is often the stepchild of health funders. And I think we do need to learn the lessons out of the COVID pandemic. It caught us, at least in the US, on a back foot of the ability to launch some of the more wide population level programs. Eventually, I think we all caught up with very widespread vaccination possibilities. But I think there are several areas in the US that are chronically underfunded in the field of public health. And I think we do need to make increasing awareness of policymakers, of professionals from the broader healthcare system, not just public health professionals, aware of the importance of an ounce of prevention, the proverbial ounce of prevention, and the ability for public health professionals to tackle that potential, why can't we sort of invest at a fraction of the cost and making the health economic argument, for example, for reducing the burden, as opposed to a lot of the efforts that and the cost implications for a curative argument that continues to dominate the healthcare system in the US and certainly globally. As you know, it's absolutely a huge challenge. It's not insignificant challenges to prioritize public health amongst a whole range of other conditions, particularly when economic conditions globally are not stable. I think it does need every bit of us doing everything possible to increase the type of awareness that's needed.
I can't think of a more poignant case in point and argument for investing in public health than hearing that every 2 minutes a woman somewhere in the world dies unnecessarily. That's such a sad statement.
It is indeed. And one of the huge underappreciated facts about cervical cancer, which I think is very increasingly recognized, is the women who die due to cervical cancer are often in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. And they leave behind not just the challenge of their own death, but a whole range and a whole generation of orphans who are going to grow up without their mothers around them. And they're going to grow up in families without a caregiver, without a income provider. And I think this causes destabilization in societies, or it has the potential for destabilizing families for certain. So the effects of cervical cancer are profound, and they are obviously we do think of the individuals who get cervical cancer and who die from the disease. But I think it's a huge problem even beyond that, and the whole intergenerational impacts that cervical cancer creates are also something that we should try to emphasize.
Dr. Vik Sastrabudi, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your service to public health. We appreciate you being a part of the National Cancer Prevention Workshop, John Dingell Cancer Health Disparities Access Interviews. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Miles, and thank you for all you do for increasing the awareness on the Hill and elsewhere to keep up with the huge challenges that we face in national in preventing cancer. So thank you for the National Cancer Workshop organizers for having me here. Appreciate it.
You're most welcome.